Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how DNA and other private data can be used or misused in law enforcement, healthcare, and employment. But first, with climate change, contamination, and a host of stressors on the planet, how will we feed a growing population? What are the politics of food? In this symposium about the future of food, recorded before a live audience, we'll turn to solutions. How can we protect long-term sustainability of healthy food? And what changes do we need to be sure our system is just, sustainable, and resilient?
My name is Manuel Vallée. I'm a senior lecturer here in the sociology department at the University of Auckland, and I'm a co-organizer for this symposium along with Maria Armudian. We have an excellent panel to discuss food-related issues. On the panel, we have Anastasia Telesetsky, who is a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland. She's co-authored and co-edited the books The International Law of Disaster Relief, Ecological Restoration and International Environmental Law, and Marine Pollution Contingency Planning, State Practices in Asia-Pacific States. Nick Lewis is an associate professor in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland. He co-edited the book Biological Economies, Experimentation, and the Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers, and he's authored book chapters including Constructing Economic Objects of Governance, the New Zealand Wine Industry. Richard Lehrheran is a professor of geography in the School of Environment at this university. He has co-authored and co-edited books including Knowledge, Industry, and Environment, Economic Spaces of Pastoral Production and Commodity Systems, and Agri-Food, Commodity Chains, and Globalizing Networks. And Michael Carolyn is a professor of sociology and the associate dean of research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University. He's authored and co-edited books including Reclaiming Food Security, The Sociology of Food and Agriculture, The Real Cost of Cheap Food, Food Utopias, Reimagining Citizenship, Ethics and Community, as well as Biological Economies, Experimentation, and Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. So with no further ado, I hand it off to Maria.
Thank you, Manuel Vallée. So what I thought we should do is first go and do a kind of a recap, but expansion. I'm going to have Michael Carolyn do this piece because it's sort of encapsulated in one of his books about cheap food. The idea is that it's really expensive. So Michael Carolyn, perhaps you can give us in a nutshell, what are these costs that we're missing when it comes to cheap food?
Thanks for inviting me and thanks for having me here. And I'll just make 2 points on that. So I did write the book, The Real Cost of Cheap Food, and the second edition just came out this year. And I do believe it's important that we think about the costs that are externalized in our food system, because as was documented extremely well with the previous panel, we lack a total cost accounting when it comes to our food system. Cheap food is a euphemism for fossil fuel dependent exploitive food. You can go on and on about what cheap food really means. But I think there's an element to that. Now, the 2 points I want to make, I think, build upon things that were just kind of subtly touched upon in the first panel. The first is we have to ask the question, why do we have cheap food to begin with? And of course, there's lots of reasons, and we can drill it all the way down to capitalism and neoliberalism. But I want to take us back to our very first cheap food, which was arguably sugar. There was a wonderful book written on the history of sugar by Sidney Mintz, the late famous food anthropologist. And he links sugar to being one of the first, if not the first, cheap foods. And he asked the question, essentially the book asked the question, why sugar and why did it emerge when it did? And part of the reason why sugar emerged as a cheap food when it did was a way of justifying low wages, right? If you are able to provide cheap calories to a workforce, then that workforce doesn't have as much authority or legitimacy to argue for a better cost of living if their cost of living is depressed in other ways, such as a slum living and feeding them sugar and things like that. And so one of the things that we have to also have a conversation about when we talk about internalizing those costs is we have to make sure that people then can afford what is inevitably going to be more expensive food, right? It's hard to say that if you internalize all the costs, even with permaculture, other things like that, that you can still have a dollar hamburger or 99-cent dozen eggs. And so one thing about food policy that I think we miss is some of these broader conversations, at least we get caught up with this in the United States, is food and farm policy is reduced to production agriculture, and it misses all these other elements. One of the biggest risk factors for hunger, for food insecurity, is poverty. So if you really want to address food security and hunger, you would address things like income, have conversations about a livable wage, have conversations about universal health care or affordable health care, have conversations about land tenure. have conversations about education. And these are conversations that I think that we sometimes miss. And it's hard. We as a society, when I talk about cheap food and the need to internalize cheap food, I'll immediately get someone raising their hand saying, what do you have against having someone afford to be able to feed themselves and their family? And they're right. Unless you have that other conversation about income or inequality, things that Annie talked about, you're missing a huge piece of this broader conversation about who has access to food and who doesn't, and who has access to a higher quality of life and who doesn't too. So the other point I'll just very briefly make too, and I think we'll talk more about this to pivot it more toward a solution piece, and it's something that I'm personally really interested in with my own research, is this question of how do we make people want to change their food system, right? I feel this viscerally as an educator too. Again, I spend entire semesters telling students how what we're currently doing is destroying our planet. And yet, I don't know if I've honestly ever changed anybody's behaviors. So I have a question about how we currently engage in politics. Now, our understanding of politics in the West is really centered upon this idea of just communication, of dialogue. It's a very, to refer to something that Annie talked about, very an unembodied understanding of politics. And I engage in that type of politics in every one of my classes where I have debates and conversations, present students with facts about why they ought to change their behavior. And I don't know if any of them actually do. And so I'm really interested as a scholar in what makes us think we ought to do something different. And I think there's a real important embodied practice material piece. And I know this sounds very abstract right now, but I think we'll have an opportunity in this panel to drill down more about what I mean by that. I think we're missing an element of our politics, a politics of care, a politics of recognition, politics of how we can empathize with people that are different and distant socially from ourselves. And until we also have a conversation about what that looks like, what that means, what does it mean to make people change their views in the world that will ultimately result in behavioral changes, I think we're missing a big piece of this conversation. How do we get people to want social change? And I think we'll maybe get to some of that later today.
And before we completely move off of that, Michael Carolyn, the cost of cheap food, there were some things in that book that you have not said and that I just wanted you to connect the dots to. One was about conflict and one was about creating more refugees. And those are two big conversations that are happening now, but they're not happening around food. How is it connected to food?
So I guess this does, a little quicker than I thought, bring us to some of the things that I've been studying about how do we make people empathize with one another, empathize with people that are different than themselves and who may live on the other side of the globe. And so let me just give really quickly two empirical examples of some things that I've found that make me hopeful in terms of some of these alternative food networks. Now, I know when we talk about alternative food networks, we talk about them often in the context of nutrition or food that's tastier or food that's been raised sustainably, but I've seen and been able to document some other elements to how some of these interactions that are based around alternative food networks might actually have some regenerative value as well. And that's around how it can make us, in some instances at least, what I like to refer to as citizen eaters as opposed to just food consumers. And so in one example, one case study, I did a longitudinal study where I interviewed roughly 110 people before they entered into an alternative food space for the first time, a cooperative, farmers markets, community support agriculture, things like that. And then I interviewed them again 2 years later, and I tried to trace their attitudinal and behavioral changes as a result of these encounters, these physical encounters that go beyond just who they talk to. And what I found interesting is I actually was able to link to these spaces, these practices, attitudinal and behavioral changes. Now, of course, the people that go into these spaces tend to be different than your regular conventional consumer. But I also discovered that their behavioral and their attitudes change as a result of these practices themselves. Now, one just quick example. When people were asked why did they enter these spaces for the first time, they overwhelmingly said they did so because they thought the food was healthier and then because they thought the food tastes better. When they were interviewed again 2 years later, they still thought those things, but they prioritized something different. They remained in those spaces because of the social connections they had with others, what it taught them about the environmental sustainability issues. And in one case, one subgroup, I interviewed people that were attached to community-supported agriculture where they had the opportunity to volunteer for their subscription. And so, in a sense, you work off some of what you owe. And what's interesting about this space is it brought affluent retirees together with immigrants from impoverished households that are very different politically and socioeconomically speaking together. And what I found is that these interactions with people that were different from themselves, even though those white, affluent, rich, in some cases conservative voters might have been into those, went to those spaces in order to get cheap, affordable, healthy, good-tasting food, they remained and stayed in those spaces because they really started to value these interactions with people different from themselves. And they began to express feelings of empathy with people who they might have 2 years prior demonized. And so I've got other cases, too, and examples like that that I might have a chance to talk about today. But I think there's some really important things that we can learn from our interactions that result from these spaces that can lead us to start to sympathize and empathize with refugees or people that are different, who pray to a different God, who have a different colored skin, who speak a different language, who may not even be within our own community, but might be living in a country thousands, tens of thousands of kilometers away. And so those are the questions that I'm really interested in, too, is, you know, how do we make people feel like they have an ethical obligation for people that they'll never meet, who may live in an entirely different country, too? And there may be some evidence that these spaces actually generate what scholars of justice refer to as a politics of recognition.
Perfect. Thank you. So now what I'd like to do, because I want to get into this idea of, can we create these new systems? And part of that may be connected to the legal issues. Anastasia Telesetsky teaches in the law school here, and she looks at these rights, like the right to food, but also a right to an environment. And where does the law come in? Where does the policy come in? Can you lay this out first, Anastasia?
Yeah, thank you very much, Maria. One of the pleasures I have this year is I'm teaching one of the first food law classes to be offered here at a New Zealand law school. And one of the subjects we're looking at is indeed the right to adequate food. And this is a right that's recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and has been expanded upon in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and is also present in some of the other international conventions to which New Zealand is a party, including the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So it is well established as a New Zealand obligation. Now, having said that, it is not part of the New Zealand Bill of Rights. It is not a component of that, and nor is it specifically, explicitly implemented through parliamentary legislation. And that has been an issue that has been raised by scholars and communities here in New Zealand. What I want to sort of share with you, because I know this is the question of what is the future of food? Well, the future of food is having a right, a human right, that is actionable. And so part of this is asking the question, with what the right to adequate food is not a calorie count. It's not whether you have 2,000 calories per day. It is a question of whether you have accessibility to food, whether you have availability of food, and that is a question of whether it is also appropriate food, culturally appropriate food, as well as food that is free from adverse substances. That is the sort of internationally agreed definition of what the right to food entails. So one of the sort of, I'm going to wind up here because I want to ensure that we have a conversation up here, but I want to emphasize that one of the things that New Zealand needs to be focusing on is having a food security plan. New Zealand does not have an explicit right to adequate food plan. And what that entails is going on the ground and looking at the sort of sources of food, trying to understand a lot of work I do in disaster law, whether New Zealand would be able to sustain the ability to keep its food supply systems open. You know, there is a lot of dependence on other nations for some of the food that is currently being supplied here in New Zealand, and raising questions about thinking about how is food more than simply an industry here, and really something that is a right. And so I'll wind up with that.
Before I let you off the hook, sure. Anastasia Telesetsky, how do we reconcile, this is both in your scholarship as well as on the previous panel, how do we reconcile that right to food with the right to a clean environment?
They're intrinsically linked. a right to food requires that the food is being raised in a sustainable fashion. And there are many ways to define sustainable, of course. But one of the movements underway is to really be thinking a lot more about, for example, agroecology, understanding what is the environmental cost of our food. Some of this requires, frankly, putting a lot more investment in, and then this would be government-oriented investment to understand how you can do food production. We know that here in New Zealand, we have a unique situation with the Maori having a lot of powerful practices and how to recover some of these practices. Some of these will be community-based, and some of these might, frankly, require some additional financing in order to scale them up.
Richard LeHaren, let's bring you in. You and Nick Lewis here to my left have both been talking about how we've bifurcated the economy from the environment and social systems and how these are actually really linked, but we don't see it that way. How do you see this as a problem that can be resolved?
Well, it's the curly tail that's a really difficult bit. We can have a discussion on the first part fairly easily. I mean, thinking about that, I'm very conscious of the fact that we could pose for the experience of the dairy industry in New Zealand, could it have been done differently? And I think the answer is that there have been other possibilities, and certainly Mike Joy, with his scholarship, has been delving into that over many years. But a couple of key points that will help get across the idea of doing dairying differently is that there has been a strong organic movement in New Zealand that came from other parts of the world that's had its ups and downs. And in the case of dairying, did have a bit of an up, and then Fonterra decided that it wouldn't purchase organic milk anymore because something had happened in the US cheese market and so on. But that stands as an alternative, and the alternative in that case, centres very much on let's keep many of the industrial chemicals out of the soil. And the second example would be biological agriculture dairying. And that's an example, largely invisible, in fact, where the emphasis is on cultivating the soil and soil biota rather than necessarily the obvious products of the cows that will produce milk and such like. And that's had an interesting history. It continues to exist. Evidence seems to be accumulating that you can make a useful living from it. But you're left with, why is it so invisible? And so what we have in those two examples, which touch on, but by no means represent the kind of overwhelming revolution that some of the speakers in the first panel were sort of edging us towards, that things can actually be done differently.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Nicholas Lewis, this brings us to you, and you, some of the things you've talked about is, well, how do we bridge the environment with the economy in such a way that's ethical or that's moral and have an economy that is a moral economy? How do you see it?
I get the toughest one. Maybe I'll edge my way into answering that question in two ways. And what Richard laid in front of you is a proposition that we need to do economy differently if we're going to address this question. We have to do food economy differently. Otherwise, we're left in a space where we have people arguing for making money out of food and being pushed into the corner of effectively arguing for the agri-science industrial complex that we've heard so much about. Or alternatively, we have people arguing for the environment and leaving the question of the economy aside and how it is that we produce, distribute food that we all rely upon. But food economy is necessary. So the question becomes, how do you do that economy? And I think by the same token, food politics is necessary. And so you have the age-old turn in good critical social science to political economy. There's no economy without politics, and there's no politics without economy. So I just want to add something to what Anastasia said and then get back to this question of moral economy. That point is that we can do this, we can hold people to account through policy and law, but we can also hold them to account in different kinds of ways. And we've been doing some work as part of the Sustainable Seas National Science Challenge with seafood and with an industry that is often held up to be one of the great devils of contemporary 21st century food, and that's the fishing industry. And through a load of pressure coming from multiple different directions, go see Seafood New Zealand's website and a set of promises about sustainable futures, about doing things differently, and in fact, promise number 6, about being transparent. And say, okay, we take you at your word. Now let's hold you to account for that word. And I think there are multiple ways of doing that, and that's a different way of thinking about consumer choice to the way we were thinking about it slightly earlier. So the return there to questions of moral economy and ethical economy is that if we do commit to doing economy differently, we have to think about economy for whom and where, or production, farming, production of food for who and where, how we do that kind of farming. And I'll just refer you to a wonderful little article written by a geographer, Peter Jackson, and some of his colleagues, who talk fundamentally about moral economy. And they raise the question of the chicken and sugar and questions like that. The more you get distanced from the social relations of production, the eater is distanced from the maker of that food, the more it is possible to ignore moral questions and ethical questions. So there is something about the way in which not just the in industrial agriculture, but the globalizing of industrial agriculture has added to these particular questions. And I will leave you with one point, if that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead, one point, because you just made me want to ask another question.
But one point is, I think the way forward on this, if I were to use one word, is experimentation. We should be encouraging and committed to experimenting in lots of different ways, in lots of different places, with making food, with distributing food, with the values, the cultural values we attach to food, the things we get out of eating, and the way we eat food. And I think that level of experimentation brings back precisely what Annie said earlier about these kinds of embodied performances of food, not just in eating it, but in making food.
Nicholas Lewis, you've said two things that prompt questions for two of the other panelists. One of them is about the globalization of food and what that has done. The other is about how really, even when we think we're eating alone, we're not eating alone, because there are all of those people that were involved in the production and the delivering and et cetera, of the food. So I think I'm going to throw the first one over to Richard LeHaron about globalization, interacting with the individual and with the community, and what that interaction is and does to our choices and what we ultimately see.
Yes, when we speak of globalization, we should also think about localization, because things are very genuinely connected. The first observation I'd make is that New Zealand almost is running at a disadvantage with respect to selling abroad. And so the connections by way of ecological scrutiny and feedback in that sense from market trends, which might be influenced by diet and such like, take a little longer to filter this way and such like. The second thing I think that is really important is that, in a sense, returning to the dairy example is probably helpful, is that what we're actually talking about is different values and expressions of those values through different means or practices or procedures of doing things. And then that, in the end, does sum up to there may be some different sorts of wider outcomes.
Can you give us some examples to make it more concrete?
Yeah, sure, sure. Well, I mean, in the case of biological agriculture, dairying, those who are committed to that will have a modest application of different fertilisers. They do an enormous amount of testing on a daily basis. And, you know, dairy farmers in New Zealand do a lot of testing, but these guys are just besotted by it. And so they really understand what's happening in the soil, because the soil translates into plant nutrition qualities, and that translates into what happens to the herd and what happens to milk quality. So ultimately, to pick up on a word that I don't think was... No, it was mentioned once in the first session, the word practices is really, really critical. And, of course, Nick's example of the seafood industry gets us right to that. We are committed to transparency. Now, transparency is a practice, a political practice, that allows others to engage in the conversation. to actually perhaps engage in some co-learning over the matter and perhaps define different sorts of commitments and so on, to take Mike's point through in terms of not quite making people do things, but at least opening pathways that allow people to arrive at more informed decisions and choices about what they might do.
Well, Michael, Carolyn, that brings you in twice. One is, first of all, that idea that you expressed in your book about eating alone, which is that we're not really eating alone. There are a lot of people involved in that. But it sounds like what you're arguing is, since there are so many people involved in that, maybe we need to connect the dots. Walk us through first what you mean by we're never eating alone, and then connect that to how do we get from point A to point B?
How we're not eating alone, where to even begin? I'll just give a couple examples. So she's referencing a book that had come out a few months ago called No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. And part of the book involves interviewing a whole host of CEOs and executives from various Fortune 500 firms, as well as interviewing food activists to try to kind of get both sides and try to tell a story about what it all means. And what was so interesting is there were even elements of our food system that I didn't even realize existed. And I've been studying it for close to 20 years now. I mean, I talked to a manager of an industrial vitamin plant in China, which was fascinating because, you know, all of our food is fortified with industrial vitamins. And we never think about where those industrial vitamins come in. We're so busy kind of tracing our food from fork to source, never even asking or even thinking to ask, where do the vitamins come from that produce that food? And he was telling me how most of their vitamin D comes from the lanolin of sheep from Australia. And so there's this crazy link from sheep and lanolin going from Australia, going to China, turned into vitamin D and going into all of our food. And I never got an answer, but if I think organic milk, at least in the States, it's fortified with vitamin D that comes from lanolin from sheep, it's still considered organic, even though the vitamin D is not. But there's just these really fascinating connections. There's all these people involved in our food system. So then it gets to the question, how do we get people to have a politics that they begin to realize that we are indeed eating alone? And we need a politics that kind of draws us outward, as opposed to what I see, we currently have a politics that more drives us inward.
We're going to close on that now and thank our amazing panelists, Nicholas Lewis and Anastasia and Michael Carolyn and Richard Leheron. It has been a great pleasure to be sitting here in the moderator chair. Thanks.
For your great questions, too. Thank you. Anastasia Telesetsky is a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland. She's co-authored and co-edited the books The International Law of Disaster Relief, Ecological Restoration and International Environmental Law, and Marine Pollution Contingency Planning, State Practices in Asia Pacific States. Nick Lewis is an associate professor in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland. He co-edited the book Biological Economies, Experimentation, and the Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. Richard Leheron is a professor of geography in the School of Environment at this university. He has co-authored and co-edited books including Knowledge, Industry, and Environment, and Agri-Food, Commodity Chains, and Globalizing Networks. And Michael Carolyn is a professor of sociology and the associate dean of research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University. He's authored and co-edited books including Reclaiming Food Security, The Real Cost of Cheap Food, as well as Food Utopias, Reimagining Citizenship, Ethics, and Community.
Tune in next week for part two of The Politics of Food. When we come back, DNA and genealogical services and the Golden State Killer investigation. Was it ethical? Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The case of the Golden State Killer has raised profound questions about ethical uses of DNA. and how popular DNA testing and genealogical services can be used or misused without users' knowledge. We have three experts on the subject with us. Ellen Wright Clayton is professor of law at Vanderbilt University School of Law, professor of health policy, and co-founder of the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society at Vanderbilt University Medical School. She's co-author of the book Bioethics in Law and co-author of Privacy and Security in the Genomic Era, Imagined Futures, Capturing the Benefits of Genome Sequencing for Society, and the Legal Risks of Returning Results of Genomics. Mark Rothstein is Chair of Law and Medicine and the Founding Director of the Institute for Bioethics, Health Policy, and Law at University of Louisville School of Medicine. He's co-author of Genetics, Ethics, Law, and Policy, and the editor of Genetic Secrets, Protecting Privacy and Confidentiality in the Genetic Era. He's also co-editor of Behavioral Genetics, The Clash of Culture and Biology. Dennis McNevin is professor of forensic genetics in the Center for Forensic Science at the University of Technology at Sydney. He is co-author of Predictive DNA Analysis for Biogeographical Ancestry, Forensic DNA Phenotyping, Developing a Model Privacy Impact Assessment, and Prediction of Biogeographical Ancestry from Genotype.
Welcome to this Scholar Circle. It's great to have you with us. What prompted this particular panel was the news story about using DNA to track down the Golden State Killer. And I thought this opens up a whole range of implications, both in the legal area, but also in medical, in personal, in the idea of discrimination based on DNA, privacy concerns. And so I thought we should start with the use of DNA in law enforcement and see if we can understand how these are done. Dennis McNevin, can you start us on this?
Sure. So the traditional use of DNA for forensic investigations has involved simply looking at genetic markers that are good at identifying people. They have no other value. They tell us very little about the individual. And if there is a match between crime scene evidence and an individual that's either on a database or a suspect, then that's very strong evidence linking that individual to the crime scene. However, that's not always the case. And quite often there's no match, and that lead will go nowhere otherwise. And so there's a big push to try and extract more information from that DNA to tell us more about the person who left that DNA behind. And obviously, in recent weeks, we've seen with the Buckskin Girl and the Golden State Killer, we've seen instances where that DNA that's been retrieved from a crime scene has been used to tell us more about the donor of that DNA. And in this particular instance, it's involved uploading to genealogy direct-to-consumer websites where putative relatives have been identified.
I see, Mark Rothstein, you have joined us now. I wonder if you might want to add to this. We're trying to understand, first of all, this use of DNA, and in particular because of the Golden State Killer, where they use this means that Dennis was just talking about. What would you add to this in terms of using these investigations, how they're changing, and what this means?
Well, there's always been an interest in expanding the capabilities of DNA forensics. And we saw very recently how that might be done through indirect and familial searches. And in a case like the, all of us were pleased from a law enforcement standpoint that the probable or possible perpetrator of these horrible crimes was finally brought to justice after such a long period of time. But my concern is with the implications of this and how it might be extended to other cases. And I don't think there's been adequate discussion of the sort of the due process and the privacy interests that we all have in balancing law enforcement with the rights of citizens.
Now, I understand what actually happened in this case, and this is just totally based on news stories, so please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the law enforcement officers actually went into one of the genealogy databases and uploaded the DNA, and I think it was GED Match in particular, which was founded by volunteers and trying to help people build their family trees, and that they were able to track down this killer based on DNA that his family members might have uploaded. What actually happened? Is this an accurate portrayal of what happened? And what does that mean, Mark Rothstein?
Well, I think that's a pretty fair summary. My understanding is that actually the link was made to DNA that was posted by a 73-year-old man in Oregon who turned out to be his third or fourth cousin. And when that individual consented, they got his DNA. And then they went through the family tree, basically, and developed a list of possible suspects. There's a second level of concern here, and that is once they focused on Mr. D'Angelo, they obtained DNA from some unspoken, unidentified, yet refuse that he put out. It could have been, you know, a cigarette butt or used chewing gum or a variety of things that he discarded. And then the police tested that and they were able to get a complete match with the crime scene evidence. So, I mean, there are a whole series of concerns in terms of the, not so much the legality. I think what they did was legal, but the implications and the policy that we need to consider.
Well, let's start going through some of these implications. Ellen Wright Clayton, let's bring you in. Why don't you start us down this path of implications?
Well, one of the things about this case is that when you post your DNA, it obviously implicates all of your biological relatives. And that was how the match was made here. And so one question that you can ask about is, should you be able to post your DNA this way? In other genealogic databases, you actually have to get permission from the person who is identified or who the match is made to see if they're willing to be in contact with you. What they did in this database was they put their DNA up there with a name, and then you could easily trace the family from that. But one of the questions from a family perspective is, should one family member be able to control what another family member does? And this is something that certainly both ethically and certainly legally is fairly problematic, to say that because I don't want you to identify me, you can't do with your DNA what you want. Now, I think the ethical question you can ask is it appropriate to make a database like this where, you know, where you don't protect the identity of the person? And so then it becomes fair game to trade everybody down to identify everyone downstream.
It's fascinating development with these genealogy databases because of exactly what you said, which is that should I not want my DNA shared, but a relative has shared his or her DNA, then I'm automatically shared in some way. Is that correct, Ellen?
That's correct. And I will say that there's nothing new about this. I mean, there was a case many years ago in Sweden where the Swedish prime minister was killed, and the perpetrator was identified by just exactly this kind of familial tracing, actually, in this case, using a newborn blood spot. So there's nothing new about familial tracing. It's just that so many people are putting out so much identified DNA that the law enforcement can go after.
Dennis McNevin, what would you add to this conversation?
I would support Ellen's comment there that there's nothing new about this. Familial searching has been occurring not just on genealogy direct-to-consumer databases, but also in criminal DNA databases, where police are able to search against records of usually people who have been convicted and charged with a crime of a certain level of seriousness. And because of the high incidence of recidivism, some leads have been generated this way. I guess the other thing that we need to consider is that DNA is just one form of intelligence that leads police to suspects. So really, social media is one of the first ports of call for forensic investigators these days. Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, all those things leave a digital trace of your history. And there is probably a lot more information about individuals on their Facebook pages than there is that is obtainable at the moment anyway from DNA. And I guess we have to look at DNA as just another form of information about people. Now, there is something that people hold sacrosanct about DNA. It is a little bit of a sacred cow. People do consider DNA to be off limits. However, the reality is that there is probably a lot more information about people on social media, and people seem to be a little less concerned about police investigating Facebook pages, for example, to look of potential suspects and where relatives and social connections could just as easily be established.
Mark Rothstein, would you agree with that assessment?
I think that's right. Today, people are putting all sorts of information about themselves and, by implication, their loved ones online for, in many cases, anyone to see. And in a case like this, I mean, the GED match had this disclaimer on the website that said, you know, this is accessible to anyone, and if you're not comfortable with that, you shouldn't put it up, or you should take it down. Well, the fact of the matter is that these sorts of warnings and disclaimers and consents, people rarely read. They just sort of click through. We've been becoming numb to these kinds of notices on the internet. And I'm afraid without much forethought. And this case, I think, from an ethics and policy standpoint, is very important because it puts the issues right out in front of us. And we would be wise to, you know, not just move on to the next item in the news cycle and spend some time trying to figure out how we want to balance the interests of society with law enforcement.
I think there are other issues in addition to law enforcement mistakes, for example, but also some things that Ellen Wright Clayton has written about in terms of discrimination based on DNA, and also the issue, and I think, Dennis, this was in your work, about the possibility of DNA surveillance. So let's start to break down what some of these sort of worst-case scenarios might be and what we might think about in terms of prevention. Ellen Wright Clayton, now, before we get into this, these concerns that you raised in your articles, in your hundreds and hundreds of articles, I thought perhaps we should also talk about that survey that you did of these companies and what you have found, including these companies that share or that include the DNA from people who've shared other people's DNA without consent. Can you walk us through what you found on these various DNA genetic genealogy websites?
Well, it's nothing short of amazing, and I have to give full credit to our postdoc, James Park. But he went through 90 privacy policies for direct-to-consumer companies. And although some of them are actually really pretty strong, namely the ones you would think of, 23andMe and Ancestry.com, others of them simply say nothing. And then it turns out that more than half of the websites are actually for surreptitious testing, to look at things like proving infidelity or proving lack of parentage, other things of that nature, which are really designed to be very, very disruptive. First of all, obviously, the person whose DNA is being stolen or submitted surreptitiously has no control over what's going on. But the people who were also doing the submitting have no earthly idea what's going to happen to that DNA and what the results are going to be. So it really is the Wild West out there. I think before we go on to the discrimination issue, I do want to make a point here that at least in the United States, forensic DNA databases broadly overrepresent minorities and mostly minority males. And so there's not a chance in the world that Mr. D'Angelo, a white former cop, would have been in those forensic databases. And so one of the things that's an interesting thing here, at least in terms of a justice concern or a discrimination concern, is that the only way they could have found him was going through a genealogy database, which, by the way, are largely populated by people who are of Northern European ancestry. So I think that there's something really interesting here about the fact that that was the only way they could have caught him was by going through a genealogy database, because our forensic databases wouldn't have had him.
Now, you talked in one of these articles about how this DNA can be misused, and in particular with things like making sure you're covered medically and making sure you can have work. What about those issues?
I want to pick up on a comment that Dennis made earlier. We have some laws, they're not very good, that at least address that in the context of access to healthcare and access to work. Actually, the Obamacare was sort of solved that problem in the United States, at least with regard to access to healthcare in a major way. But what I find interesting is that I'd rather lose my DNA before a whole host of other information. If I lost my electronic medical record, if my finances got hacked, those things are much more worrisome to me than if someone were able to get my DNA sequence.
Before you go on, Ellen, why is it that you're not as concerned about your DNA as you are about medical records, given what might be able to be done with your DNA?
Because frankly, what's in my medical record says more about me as I am, as a product of genetics and environment and many other things, than my DNA sequence ever will.
I support what Ellen says 100% there. I think we should be...
Is that Dennis?
Yes, it is.
Dennis
Sorry.
McNevin.
Sorry, it's Dennis here. Yeah, look, I think we should be equally concerned about what's in the digital sphere as our DNA. I mean, there is so much information. Mobile phones are tracking devices. As Mark commented earlier, people are becoming numb to consent, to the fine print, and just press consent on apps all the time. And so we allow Google and Facebook to track our locations. And every time we make an automatic withdrawal of cash from an auto teller, that's logging information about us. Every time we go through an automatic road toll, that's logging information about us. I mean, there is a lot of information in the digital sphere that has to be protected just as much as DNA, in my opinion.
Are all of these types of data, whether they are coming from DNA or whether they're coming from your social media, all of those types of things, are they all stored in law enforcement databases today?
This is Dennis here. So no, they are not. The only things that are stored in law enforcement databases, in Australia anyway, I can't comment about the US, is DNA and fingerprints. The legal principle here is that if you are convicted of a crime and you achieve a level of a certain seriousness, then you sacrifice the right to the privacy over your DNA and your fingerprints. So that information is stored on a database against your will. Now, that only applies to that information. So other digital information is not stored by law enforcement databases. However, that's not to say that warrants can't be issued to access that information if there are fair and reasonable grounds for police investigators to think that that's a reasonable avenue of investigation.
Mark Rothstein, what about the USA?
Well, the U.S. law enforcement does not routinely collect all of the ancillary matters that they could through the internet. They have fingerprints and, for some individuals, a DNA sample. And the question I think that we need to answer in the U.S. as well as everywhere else is, in an information-rich era, how much do we want the government and law enforcement to routinely, without a warrant, without probable cause, compile about individuals? Do we want the government to be able to aggregate, in a sort of a big data sense, all these diverse things that are where we've been and what we spend our money on and what books we've ordered and who our friends are, et cetera, to try to get a picture of us for whatever purposes might be used? I think the recent scandal, if you will, with Facebook is another sort of a rude shock to many of us, that it's hard to even fathom the range of nefarious purposes that composite information can be used. And it's going to get really out of hand unless we kind of get our arms wrapped around it.
Well, maybe that's what we should do in our last few minutes, is talk about what are some of the ways that this information, whether it is harvested from our DNA, from our family's DNA, from our Facebook page, from our telephones, what are the protective ethical policies that we can advance to protect this basic, what we would consider generally as a fundamental right? Ellen, would you like to start?
Yes, I'd love to. I think, first of all, we need to think about putting controls on, you know, what the government does when they use these data. And I think that we ought to consider what kinds of prior permission, like warrants or other things that they need to use in order to access these data. And frankly, one problem in the United States is that our courts have been much more permissive about when you can collect DNA information from people than has been the case around the world. So I think those are important issues. The other thing that I think is really important is that we need to be really serious about what the big data tech companies are collecting and how they are distributing it for use by other people. Because, you know, frankly, in some ways, Facebook and Google have much more information about me than the federal government does. And their control of how it's used is absolutely not transparent to me or to anyone else. And I think that we need to think not only about what the government's doing, but also about what data aggregators are doing with all these data.
Dennis McNevin.
I'm not an expert on digital data, but if I can return to the subject of DNA, then, you know, one thing we can do is instigate a process of what's termed sequential unmasking. And that's where we only look at the information that's relevant to the purpose at hand. So for a forensic investigation, if you're extracting a DNA profile, then we don't sequence the whole genome of an individual because that's too much information. Firstly, it's too expensive to do anyway on a routine basis. But secondly, most of the DNA sequence is irrelevant for the purposes of forensic investigation. So we would first look at only those genetic markers that might provide a DNA match. If a match occurs, there's no need to go any further. We're led to a suspect. If there's no match, then we only look at a few more genetic markers that might tell us about what that person looks like. Their hair color, their eye color, for example, perhaps their genetic ancestry, which would give us another lead. And so in this way, we sequentially release information from the genome and don't look at the rest of it. We purposely don't analyze the rest of the DNA data. And that's perhaps one protection that we could put in place to ensure that there's some level of genetic privacy.
I think it was your work, Dennis McNevin, that looked at sort of a comparative protection of genetic information. I think you said Australia deems it as sensitive and the European Union does as well, but the U.S. does not. What do we know about the level of protection there?
Well, I can't comment on the U.S. I'll leave that to your other two guests. But the problem in Australia and Europe and many parts of the world is that the legislation is largely silent about the use of DNA. The Netherlands has specific legislation that dictates exactly what DNA can be used for in forensic investigations. And the highest court in France has also, in 2014, issued a ruling about the use of DNA for forensic purposes. But otherwise, around the world, there's very little that's been said legally. And the problem here is that technology has run ahead of the law, and the law has got to catch up. I guess this is probably going to play out in the courts in terms of test cases, but it's a frontier that's largely unknown legally, and I think we need to watch this space to see what happens in the courts.
Mark Rothstein.
Well, I'd like to talk about just one sort of concrete thing that I think would be very helpful. The law has developed in the United States that once an individual abandons an item, let's say chewing gum or cigarette butt or anything, then anyone who picks it up can do whatever they want with it, including DNA testing. And I think this is a great source of mischief in the United States. As Ellen talked earlier about some of these rather sleazy websites that will do any DNA testing on any object that you send in as long as you send the money. It's used for purposes that are sort of extrajudicial. In the UK, legislation was enacted that bans non-consensual genetic testing. And I think that would be something that we ought to look at in the United States. In the years to come, not only will we be able to send a chewing gum sample or a child's lollipop to a laboratory with new handheld technology using nanopores, we might actually be able to do it ourselves. And I think that what we don't want to have is a nation of people who are, you know, willy-nilly doing curiosity or pernicious testing of family members and others.
Final word, Ellen Wright Clayton.
I think this has been a wonderful conversation, and it just really shows that we're trying to figure out how to move forward as individuals in a big data society. And these exactly are the kinds of conversations we need to be having.
Well, I thank the three of you very much. I think it calls out for a part two very soon. I thank you for your time, your research, and your thoughts.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Ellen Wright Clayton is professor of law at Vanderbilt University School of Law, professor of health policy, and co-founder of the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society at Vanderbilt University Medical School. She's co-author of the book Bioethics in Law and co-author of Privacy and Security in the Genomic Era, Imagined Futures, Capturing the Benefits of Genome Sequencing for Society, and the Legal Risks of Returning Results of Genomics. Mark Rothstein is chair of law and medicine and the founding director of the Institute for Bioethics, Health Policy, and Law at University of Louisville School of Medicine. He's co-author of Genetics, Ethics, Law, and Policy, and the editor of Genetic Secrets, Protecting Privacy and Confidentiality in the Genetic Era. He's also co-editor of Behavioral Genetics, The Clash of Culture and Biology. Dennis McNevin is professor of forensic genetics in the Center for Forensic Science at the University of Technology at Sydney. He is co-author of Predictive DNA Analysis for Biogeographical Ancestry, Forensic DNA Phenotyping, Developing a Model Privacy Impact Assessment, and Prediction of Biogeographical Ancestry from Genotype.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.